Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Great Depression was winding down. FDR was in the White House, Joe Louis in the boxing ring, Amelia Earhart in the air, and the sounds of swing were sweeping the nation. In clubs and living rooms, Americans were dancing to a new rhythm. It crossed lines and cultures, became the soundtrack of an era, and nobody played it like the big band of William Count Basie. This hour On Point, we're listening back to Count Basie and the soundtrack of a generation and looking for the American soundtrack today. You can join the conversation. Do Count Basie and swing still bring to life an era for you? Does America have a soundtrack now? One guest today says maybe Gnarls Barkley, Erykah Badu, Beck. What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We'll hear later in this hour from music maven Tim Riley on the American soundtrack today. But joining me first from New York is Roxanne Orgill, an award-winning music critic whose reviews and articles have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and Billboard. She's out with a terrific new book called Dream Lucky, about celebrated swing musician Count Basie and his meteoric rise to fame in the 1930s. Roxanne Orgill, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Hey, this
Hello,
is
a, Tom.
This is some kind of great book, sort of history as scat. I mean, you're writing wonderfully here and weaving so much in around the music, but you start as a music critic. How did this music get its hook into you, Roxanne?
I think it started with one of the tunes I hope we'll hear today called Topsy. It just sent me, as they would say in the 30s. I fell in love with this band. I, of course, knew the music as a music critic, but when I started listening harder to it, I realized how spontaneous the band was, and how great the soloists were, how cool and reserved Basie's piano playing was.
Hey, Topsy,
went on from there.
Let's hear it right now. 1937, Count Basie, Topsy. Count Basie's band in Topsy, 1937, Buck Clayton on the trumpet with the mute you hear there, Jack Washington on the baritone sax solo. Basie comes in with a rare solo himself here. Introduce us to William Basie, Count Basie, Roxanne. Who was he? Where'd he come from?
Well, he came from Red Bank, New Jersey, and when he was a young man, he went to Kansas City, and that's the city most associated with him besides New York, because he put together a little group called 3-3-3 and played in a little tiny club called the Reno, which is probably called it a hole-in-the-wall place. That's where he got his start as a band leader. Before that, he was in Benny Moten's band. Benny Moten was a piano player, so he had his own band, and that's what Basie played too. But Basie found a way to worm his way into a band that already had a piano player. He was that kind of guy.
And before that, playing piano in vaudeville, kind of got stranded in Kansas City, but also made his bones there, and then came blasting out. You describe him as a kind of his music as just soaking up the times. There's a little bit right in the prologue of your book, Dream Lucky, that I wish you'd read for us, Roxanne, to kind of put a backdrop to this music we're going to be hearing today.
Sure. The radio was always on, and the dial was tuned to Jack Benny, J-E-L-L-O, or The Shadow. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? Or Burns and Allen, Say Goodnight, Gracie, or a fireside chat, My Friends. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was in the White House, and Eleanor Roosevelt was everywhere. Together they had lifted the country out of the Depression somewhat. Well, the shanty town was gone from Central Park, at least. The president was occupied with his recovery programs, and Eleanor was worried about the civil rights, because Franklin wasn't. She should have been president, some said. In New York, the traffic cops wore white gloves, and Sixth Avenue still had an elevated. There were telephone exchanges, dial Audubon 3-2400, and Pullman cars in Grand Central, and everyone wore a hat, except Amelia Earhart when she announced her flight around the world at its waistline in the Hotel Barclay. Her husband hated her in hats. At the movies, seven little men in long beards whistled while they worked, and there were newsreels. There goes Eleanor in a helmet descending into a coal mine.
Just a little bit of the flavor of the late 1930s when Count Basie began to take the country by storm. Roxanne Orgill reading there from her new book, Dream Lucky. Of course, there were already, Duke Ellington was out there, Cab Calloway, Earl Hines, and right on down, Chick Webb, and of course, Benny Goodman and Jimmy Dorsey, Tommy Dorsey, Artie Shaw, all those. In that amazing sort of pantheon of that time, Where does Basie stand? What was it about him or his distinctive sound that set him apart?
Well, my book tells the story of him starting out and trying to get into that scene. Benny Goodman had just recently become a star. He was doing shows at the Paramount, five shows a day at the Paramount for the teenagers. So he'd hit it real big, and Basie wanted to be part of that. In the course of the book, he does become a part of that, slowly, laboriously, bombing several times before he gets there. But I think what set him apart was when he blew into New York City, they hadn't heard anything like his sound, the Kansas City sound, so-called. It had a really strong rhythm section. The band was not playing, for the most part, written-down arrangements. They were all what they call head arrangements, made up on the spot. They would play the same thing over and over as the nights went on, but with variation. So there was this spontaneous, fresh sound that was completely unlike Goodman and the white bands. And I think that's how he made his mark. There were a lot of other black bands doing that kind of sound, more or less, but he had that particular Kansas City sound that he brought to New York. And
let's listen to a little bit of it right here. Yes, they did. And, of course, radio, as you read earlier there, was coming on like gangbusters and everybody listening all the time, all over the place. Here's Mama Don't Want No Peas and Rice and Coconut Oil, 1938. Count Basie didn't want to record this song, kind of a novelty song, agreed to do it in exchange for a pair of tickets to the second Joe Louis-Max Schmeling fight. Here we go.
Rice, coconut oil. Mama don't want no peas and rice. Mama don't want no coconut oil. Just a bottle of brandy handy all the day. Mama don't want no gin because it would make her sin. Mama don't want no gin because it would make her sin.
Roxanne Orgill, you tell the story of him agreeing to do this for tickets to the great Joe Louis Max Schmeling fight, and then dropping his Panama hat at the beginning of the fight and missing it. It went so fast.
Yes, it only lasted 2 minutes and 4 seconds, and of course Joe Louis won that one. He had lost the one 2 years previously, with which I begin the book. He lost it in 12 rounds of grueling, horrible fight to Max Schmeling. So this was a wonderful victory, but Count Basie missed it.
Max Schmeling, of course, out of Hitler's Germany, Joe Louis, a hero to millions of Americans and black Americans in particular, devastated when he lost, elated when he won. What did swing music mean to this country, Roxanne? What was the amalgamum that we heard in swing?
I think that the thing we forget about in this day and age is that it was dance music. It was not meant to, you didn't sit and listen to it. Even if it was on the radio, you got up and danced, I think. But it was dance music, it was social music, it was not something you listen to alone at home, and you know, very different from today, our music. So I think people needed to get out and dance and cheer themselves up, quite frankly.
When people heard swing with that driving rhythm, and especially in Count Basie's work, did they hear America's races beginning to kind of meld musically, at least? Were people aware of that? Did they feel it, hear it that way?
That's a good question. Oh boy, I've tried. You know, I spent 6 years on this book trying to imagine myself into the late 30s. I don't know if I can imagine myself into that, but I think that this music certainly did integrate, play a part in the integration of the races, because people like Benny Goodman, when he introduced swing to Carnegie Hall, he brought Count Basie on the stage with him for a jam session, and that had never happened before. He also, of course, integrated with his small group with Teddy Wilson and Lionel Hampton, his quartet. So the integration was going on, but it was also very segregated. There were black bands and there were white bands, and they didn't mix.
And their audiences, not much, though at times. Roxanne Orgill tells the story of Count Basie in a new book, Dream Lucky, and it's quite a wonderful sort of musical dive into a time, a history, and a soundtrack in many ways of that time. Roxanne Orgill in New York, please stand by. Listeners, you can join us. Can you imagine, can you remember when the whole country was swinging to this? Here's Count Basie with Honeysuckle Rose. And what does the sound of swing of Count Basie say to you? What was the time, the country, that embraced this as its soundtrack? And we're going to talk a little bit later about today. Do we have a soundtrack in this country today? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Count Basie and the American soundtrack of the late 1930s, years of Depression, FDR, Amelia Earhart, Joe Louis, and swing. And we're asking if America has a soundtrack. Today, Roxanne Orgill is my guest. She's author of the wonderful new book. It's called Dream Lucky, about Count Basie's rise and his music. You can join the conversation. What was the time, the country that embraced this as its soundtrack? And behind me right now, Jumping at the Woodside, Count Basie, 1938. Do you hear melting pot here, racial melding, the urge to dance? Who could miss that? And if this was your grandparents' music, does it still speak to you? What about now? Does America have a soundtrack today? Who plays it? Who sings it? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Dream Lucky, where's it come from, Roxanne?
Oh, the title. Yes, that comes from a song that Jimmy Rushing, who was Count Basie's vocalist, one of them, sang. And when I heard it, I knew I had my title. The lyric goes, did you ever dream lucky, baby, and wake up cold in hand? You didn't have a dollar. Somebody had your woman.
It's great. It's great. You write about a moment where, I mean, this is the time of Duke Ellington and Earl Hines and then Count Basie. A lot of aristocracy flowing here. But you write about the moment when on Count Basie's way out of Kansas City to get in that bus, head onto that two-lane highway, he's actually given a kind of a send-off, good luck, you can do it, by Duke Ellington himself. What was that meeting?
Oh, yes. Basie was at a place called Paseo Hall, and he was going to be followed there by Duke Ellington and his band. Of course, Duke Ellington was totally famous by that point. But in the great fraternity of jazz, he was kind to Basie, and he saw them getting their instruments, putting their instruments onto the bus to head up to Chicago and leave Kansas City, which forever. And he said, "You can make it," to Basie, and that meant a lot to him.
Go ahead, said Duke Ellington, "you can make it," and you're right. Those were six words he could tuck in the brim of his fedora in a time when everybody had hats. Maybe just took them off to dance. Maybe. Let's turn to our listeners from Hartsville, South Carolina. Viana is calling. Viana, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm here.
Hi. What do you know, Viana?
Well, I'm the granddaughter of the woman who had a famous supper club in Kansas City, Missouri. It was called Lucille's Paradise. I'm named after her. That is my middle name.
Yeah.
And she had just about everybody that you can think of from that era in her supper club playing many, many times. I remember as a little girl in the early 40s going there during the day and watching them prepare for the night. But
how fantastic. And Count Basie, did he make your grandmother's scene, Lucille's Paradise, Bianca?
Oh, absolutely. Count Basie, Enoch Light, Cab Calloway, Jack Teagarden, Guy Lombardo, Eddie Duchin, Artie Shaw.
So her supper club was, it was also a club where black and white played. What was that like? What was the sort of the racial makeup rules, were there any? Was your grandmother, you know, a progressive club owner?
She was very progressive. Blacks would play, the black musicians would play first. And the white musicians would play at a hotel called the Roosevelt, I believe it was, a Roosevelt Hotel. And then at 1 o'clock, they would come over, 1 o'clock in the morning, and they would jam together until about 6 in the morning. And then they would have to close the club for 1 hour, then they could open it again.
Wow. When you close your eyes and hear this music again, Vianna, what does it mean to you? What's the picture that it brings back to mind?
Oh, I thoroughly enjoy it. I've got lots of jazz records. I thoroughly enjoy that music. I guess it's because it was in my blood from a little girl.
Roxanne, do you know the club, Lucille's Paradise? Does it make
Lucille's Paradise. At this time, I don't know what's there because I haven't been back to Kansas City in a long time. But I do know, and I even have a picture somewhere, it's a, what do you call it, a state monument?
No kidding.
And there is a plaque on the front of this place of business that says Lucille's Paradise, but I don't think they go by that name now.
Roxanne, what do you hear in Vianna's report from days of yore?
Oh, I would have loved to have been there. I envy you. you know, as I said, I spent all these years imagining being there, and that's the best I could do. I hear that I would have loved to have just been part of that whole Kansas City scene with so many clubs. I don't know that one in particular, but so many clubs operating at the same time. And from what someone told me the other day, Kansas City still has a very lively jazz scene, and I hope to get there soon.
Vianna, thank you very much for calling. Count Basie all over. It wasn't a quick trip to New York, and it wasn't a quick trip onto the big national stage. Of course, he had played with Ella Fitzgerald. He played with Billie Holiday, and let's listen to a little bit of that right here. Swing Brothers Swing, Billie Holiday with Count Basie, 1937.
Now we're going to ask Count Basie and all the cats to swing on down to the tune called Swing Brothers Swing.
Deep rhythm captivates me. Hot rhythm stimulates me. Can't help but swing it, boy. Swing it, brother, swing. Don't stop to diddle-daddle. Stop this foolish prattle.
1937, Billie Holiday with Count Basie. That recorded at the Savoy Ballroom in New York. But they played all over. Roxanne Orgill, you've got this amazing story out of Detroit, where Count Basie was on the bill with, of all things, James Cagney as a band leader. I mean, he'd been in the movie Something to Sing About as a band leader. Basie comes to town, he plays, and by the time he's into his, third or fourth set or performance show of the day, he's in trouble with the Detroit manager, and it leads to a really poignant story about race perceptions, race expectations. There's a reading here, but set it up for us, Roxanne. What happened in this encounter with Billie Holiday there between Count Basie and the Detroit club manager?
Well, Billie Holiday was determined to be too light-skinned. They were afraid that she would look white if the lights hit her in a certain way. And so
Why was that a problem?
Not allowed. You could not have mixing on the stage. So it couldn't even be perceived that she was white, singing with a colored, in the parlance of the day, colored band. And so the solution they came up with was to black up, to put on black makeup, you know, from the old minstrel show days.
That a black singer, even Billie Holiday, would be, was being very specifically asked here by the Detroit manager to darken her skin.
Yes.
It's amazing.
It's pretty incredible, isn't it?
It is incredible. You write that that Basie was in love with her in many ways, not like Freddie Green, who was on the road, you know, very close to her sometimes. But he was just crazy about her in the way that Lester Young was. I wish you'd read for us how this all unfolded a little bit from Dream Lucky, Roxanne.
She didn't sing pretty. Her tone was thin and reedy. But, oh, it was a gas to be two-fingering it alongside her on Swing Brother Swing when she interrupted the lyric to sing, "Come on, send me, Count," like a stick hitting a drumhead, making him want to push the band harder, harder. Yeah, Basie loved Billy an awful lot. He called her William, and she called him Daddy Basie. How was he supposed to muster the gumption to say, "I know it's wrong, William, but could you just do it this once?" As things turned out, Basie didn't have to say a word, because Billy, meanwhile, was doing some quick figuring on her own. Being discriminated against was nothing new. At the famous door in New York in 35, she had had to wait upstairs in a hallway just outside the bathrooms, in her white evening dress, because the manager wouldn't let her sit in the club when she wasn't singing. Now she was supposed to darken her face like a coon in a minstrel show. As Prez, that's Lester Young, would say whenever he sensed the chill of injustice, "I feel a draft." If she refused to go along and put on the paint, and word got out, it would mess up Basie's bookings for a while, maybe longer. She couldn't do that to the cats in the band. Lady blacked up. She darkened her skin so the show could go on. Sometimes things can look so terribly wrong that they're funny. When Harry Edison came out on stage, dangling his trumpet in his fingers, and saw Billy looking as black as an African, he laughed. Lady turned around and called him something unquotable, and the show went on.
Roxanne Orgill reading from Dream Lucky, an incredible moment in jazz history as Lady, Billie Holiday, blacked up with the dark grease paint to be black enough to be on stage with African-American musicians in Detroit. Incredible. Let's take a call from Swampscott, Massachusetts. And Bill. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm enjoying the radio broadcast.
Great.
I have a short comment that this is music that I love very much, and it's music of my dad and grandfather, but anyone that likes Basie should find some Benny Moten CDs, which you can find. There's several of them available.
Who he played with, as Roxanne says, in Kansas City.
The Kansas City band that was just, that was the precursor of Basie's group, and there's quite a interaction between Basie and Moten, and then Moten died prematurely on the surgeon's table, and Basie wound up taking over this band. And if you hear Moten's band, they just had a fantastic sound to them. It's for music lovers, you'll just like it a lot.
Wonderful. Bill, that's fantastic. Thanks for calling. Let me get another call here from New London, Connecticut, and Charles, you're on the air.
Hi. It's great to hear this. This is the music I grew up with, though I wasn't born until 49. My parents told the story, it must have been 1946, right after the war. Basie came to town to Champaign-Urbana, Illinois.
Sure, know it well.
And the band couldn't find any place that would let them stay and eat.
Mm.
So most of the band stayed in my parents' little apartment, and my mother used to love to tell the story of making up a dinner for about 10 of these guys.
Wow. That's an incredible story, Charles. In Champaign, Illinois, with Count Basie's band in your parents' home. That's just terrific. Thanks very much for that. Roxanne Orgill, I wanted to ask you, the Wall Street Journal gave your book a great review. Eddie Dean wrote it up, and the headline they gave it was "When America Had a Soundtrack." I wonder if, as you wrote this, I mean, you've woven events and characters and people of that time and the music so closely together, it all does flow. Did you hear it in your mind's ear as a soundtrack for the country, in a sense? It's kind of somehow crystallizing what this country was about at that moment.
Oh, definitely. I like how you point that out. I think I didn't realize it till you just said it. But yes, it started out. The book started out as a story about Basie, but trying to make it in New York. But then I started wondering what was going on at the same time, and FDR was in his just about ready to wrap up his first term, and he was. Saying in his second inaugural address, for example, he said, "I see one-third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished," those famous words.
Yes.
And one in two Americans owned a radio. And when I read that and heard that, I wondered what was on the radio beside the music. And, of course, it was Jack Benny and Fibber McGee and Molly and Burns and Allen and The Lone Ranger and The Shadow, all those shows. And I put them all in the book, too. So I think the soundtrack includes all that was on the radio, which was a lot of drama and a lot of comedy, hilarious comedy.
And especially late at night, on came Swing.
The big bands.
Yeah.
Yes.
Here's How Long Blues, Count Basie, 1938. How Long Blues, Count Basie, 1938. Roxanne Orgill writes about the story behind it, and it's a good one, in her book, Dream Lucky. We're thinking about country, its music, the time when the country kind of had a soundtrack, and wondering whether it does now. Tim Riley's been listening along a little bit from Concord, Massachusetts. He's a music critic, author of books about the Beatles, Bob Dylan, Madonna. His latest book is called Fever, How Rock Transformed Gender. He's a great and welcome guest here over time. Tim Riley, we know you're listening there. Thanks so much for being with us.
Nice to be here.
The country, this country, and a soundtrack. Can you hear this as the soundtrack of a time then? And we're going to hear more on this front. We're going to change the sound a little bit. But do we have a soundtrack today that compares to what they had here in the late 1930s with Count Basie and the Swing Gang?
Well, we do. But I would say that we have several soundtracks, and that those soundtracks reflect both the diversity alive in the audience and, of course, the diversity of media outlets that have grown since then. I mean, you're talking about radio. You're talking about a day before television. And of course, television transforms the way people experience and consume music. And now with the Internet, you know, we have a fire hose of media opportunities for people now. And back in those days, you really had, you know, comparatively, these really tiny portholes that musicians were able to sing and play through. So I think that the analogy would be we have soundtracks today just as we have many, many outlets today for all different kinds of media.
But we're going to come back after a break and flip the switch a little bit, test your ears, dear listeners, and think about soundtracks today. Maybe airs in some way to Count Basie, whether we've got a soundtrack in this country. Roxanne Orgill, that radio was so powerful, so omnipresent, and so solo in those days as the way people heard. Unless they were actually at the club, they heard the music of the country.
Yes, didn't they? I'll be very interested to see hear what Mr. Riley has to say, because it was relatively homogeneous, wasn't it then?
Yes, and that got reflected right through the music.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to come back still using radio to listen to a sound from a different time after a short break right here. Tim Riley, we're so glad to have you with us. Roxanne Orgill is here. Her new book is Dream Lucky. Listeners, we're happy to hear more from you on the Count Basie front. We're going to change gears as well, so hold on to your hats. What do you think? What about now? Does America have a soundtrack today? Who plays it? Who sings it? Do we have a shared beat or millions of iPod isolation units? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Here's Count Basie with Doggin' Around, 1938. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
got some bad news this morning.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've been talking about Count Basie and the American soundtrack of the late 1930s, years of depression and swing. But we're also asking whether this country has a soundtrack today that sort of merits the title. Roxanne Orgill is with us. She's written a terrific new book about Count Basie and his times. It's called Dream Lucky, and I really recommend it. It's just terrific, kind of history as scat or scat as history. We've also been joined by Tim Riley, wonderful music critic, author of books about the Beatles, Bob Dylan, and Madonna. He blogs at artsjournal.com/Riley, and he also oversees the RileyRockIndex.com. It's a link farm for music of all kinds of genres. Among those you can find there, behind us right now, Gnarls Barkley with Who's Gonna Save My Soul. You can join the conversation. What was the time, the country that embraced Count Basie and swing as its soundtrack? And does America have a soundtrack today? Who would you say plays it? Who sings it? Can we have an it, a one, a soundtrack anymore? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Tim Riley, you're a good sport to sort of take this on as a thought exercise, and you've given us some suggestions here for maybe some kind of sound of soundtrack today. Gnarls Barkley is on it right here behind us. Give us your thought process, Tim.
Well, I chose to play Gnarls Barkley today when I heard we were doing Count Basie, because both of these groups, Count Basie, he got very elaborate like Ellington and took jazz and big band stuff into a certain direction. But he was also building and playing off of the blues. And Gnarls Barkley, I hear a lot of the same roots at work. It's just going off in a different direction. And so you really cannot ever underestimate the wellspring that the blues has provided for pop musicians throughout the last century and now on into this century. And even as they're employing a whole host of new electronic gadgetry and sound sampling and cross-fading between old records and brand new sample sounds and really stuff that would have sounded really futuristic to Count Basie's ears, he would have recognized that the R&B roots, the rhythm and blues roots, and the blues roots, the same chord progressions, and a lot of the same themes are being used by Gnarls Barkley to create this much more futuristic sound.
So we've got
are giving hosannas to the Gnarls Barkley record is that it is a very interesting eclectic mix of a lot of different styles woven in.
So an heir to Count Basie in a way, maybe a soundtrack, and it's eclectic, and we are one eclectic nation. Roxanne, I want to get you on that, but let's turn to our listeners as well. John in Newton, Massachusetts. You're on the air, John.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for another great show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to mention a couple of things about the Count Basie Band before they left Kansas City. It seems that Ms. Orgill's book is probably focused more on what happened after that. But
yeah, they head to New York in big times, big things.
You could do a whole show on Kansas City, I'm sure. But the interesting thing was that it was very isolated, and the most advanced swing musicians were considered to be in New York City, and no one was quite aware of what was really going on in Kansas City, except for when musicians would come back from tours of the Southwest and come back to New York City and talk about the amazing musicians that were out there. And the Count Basie Band would be very significant if they had never left Kansas City, because that Count Basie rhythm section with Walter Page, Joe Jones, and Freddie Green and Count Basie on piano was the prototypical modern jazz rhythm section. And what they did in Kansas City was the direct precursor to the modern jazz era. And in fact, Kansas City had all the most advanced jazz soloists, and so in many senses they were ahead of the musicians in New York City.
Moving from the great age of melody into the age of rhythm that we're still very much in the midst of.
And new harmonic territory. And before the Basie Band even recorded, Charlie Parker was sitting in the audience in the Reno Club absorbing the lessons of Basie Band and the advanced swing musicians, and that enabled Charlie Parker to come out of nowhere, even before 1940, with the next step in jazz, even before the Count Basie Band really became widely known in the rest of the country.
All kinds of two-lane highways intersecting there in Kansas City. John, thanks very much for that. And Roxanne, I want to get you on this lineage and the sort of rolling forward soundtrack. Let's have a little more gnarls in our ears as we do it. Here's Charity Case from the Odd Couple album, 08, latest collaboration between the rappers CeeLo Green and producer Danger Mouse. New York Times describes this the album as miserable exuberance. Roxanne Orgill, how about it? Rhythm as a real marker of Count Basie, that spare rhythm that he had. Do you hear, you know, his airs in Gnarls Barkley? And as a music critic, do you hear something, if Basie was part of the soundtrack of the 30s, do you hear what 21st century soundtrack behind us right here?
You can't see me, but I'm smiling listening to this. I haven't heard this music before. Boy, I can hear the rhythm section. I can relate the Basie rhythm section to this, but the rhythm is completely different. It's pronounced in the same way. There's a chorus singing instead of a single singer, a backup group, which Basie didn't have. I'm thinking mainly of all the differences, but it does sound contemporary. It sounds like the music of my life right now. I'm not sure how I could say how. Perhaps Mr. Riley can tell us why that is.
Tim, we'll come to you on that. Let's get a listener in on it. Lee in Providence, Rhode Island. You're on the air, Lee.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Wonderful. What do you hear, Lee?
Well, I got to say that I'm a musician, and I go to Berklee College of Music in Boston, and one of the first things that we learn there is that, you know, it all comes from R&B, it all comes from blues, and it all comes from black music, and I got to say that, like, you know, it's amazing how much we're still influenced by so much that is from so far before us.
So long before us. Indeed, Liam, I'm afraid we lost you there, but we love your point, and let's get another here from Salt Lake City and Charles. Charles, you're on the air.
Hello, and great show as always, Tom.
Thanks.
I'm more curious about the social elements of it. To me, the music of the 1930s tended to bring a nation together and lift its spirits at a very trying time, and I'm curious what your guests think about the music today, and how does the music today bring together a nation during a very troubled time, or are we all just disparate tones? And I'll listen to you up the air. Thank you.
Charles, it's a great question, and we will bring it up. Let's get one more call before we do. Rick in Punta Gorda, Florida. Rick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Love the show. I guess I just wanted to affirm the point that maybe the second speaker made about, you know, the way, you know, media has changed the lives of people today, you know, creating a soundtrack much more diverse than maybe the one people had in the past. And it's changed my life. Here I am, an American educated young man. I'm into Brazilian music, jazz, pop, country, so many different things. So the soundtrack is quite a jumbled mess at this point.
So what, do we may lose something in unity? Do we gain it in diversity, Rick?
I think that's the key. You know, we really gain a lot of diversity with the media that we have today.
All right. Our listeners are fantastic. They put a lot on the table as we respond to it. Let's have one more of Tim Riley's maybe nominees for current American soundtrack in our ear. Here from Erica Badu is The Cell off her album New America Part 1, Fourth World War.
Sister gone numb with pain, the same. Why? Same DNA sale.
Erica Badu, The Cell, from her album New America. Tim Riley, music critic, is a good sport in putting forth some nominees for American soundtrack today. Tim, as we listen, what about our caller's point? Charles in Salt Lake City says, you know, this swing music, and of course Count Basie wasn't the only one, but he was very prominent there. It brought a unity via those big old wooden radios to the country. Today we're all on our own iPods. Rick in Florida says, yeah, but there's diversity has its own rewards. Is there a unifying theme? Do we have to have one to have something we call a soundtrack, Tim?
Well, here's how I look at this. I think that throughout music history, you've seen a pendulum swing between these great unifiers who come along and who show us all the connections that are to be made among the different styles that are at play out there in people's everyday lives. And then it swings back and we get more diversity. I'm looking at the top 10 records on the Billboard charts right now. And number 5 is Frank Sinatra.
Wow.
Which just, and so you have number 1 is Usher, and number 4 is Bun B, and number 5 is Leona Lewis. So you have, you know, a rapper, an R&B-er, a diva balladeer, and then Frank Sinatra. And so what you have really reflected in the top records of the country are these incredibly diverse tastes. And it'd be very hard to imagine the people who are running out to buy the Bun B record are also listening to Frank Sinatra. Some of them are.
And yet, at the same time, Roxanne, there's something to celebrate in the fact that we're very self-aware as a nation, that we're listening to lots of stuff, and maybe part of our hallmark that we're happy with and proud of is just that diversity of tastes and the freedom to run around and hear it all, Roxanne.
Yes, I think you're right, and I think that whether we're aware of the lineage or not, if we don't even know our music history, I'm hearing Billie Holiday and Erykah Badu. I'm hearing gospel music in her backup chorus. It's all there. We can still hear it even if it's not conscious, and I think it's just such a diverse, wonderful musical history that we have as a country.
Daniel in Somerville, Massachusetts, you're on the air, friend.
Hi there, Tom. Hi. I'm a longtime music critic, and first of all, I believe that music critics always put a good gloss on things, because if they were as grumpy and negative as they might want to be, they wouldn't have jobs.
Well, yeah, that's
but
things
that
built in.
I also think that there's no national music now. Everything is, you know, in little compartments, so you can't say that there's a national soundtrack. But I think the national soundtrack really fell apart when musicians were able to sell 10 million copies, because black musicians in the 30s, the 20s, the 40s, they couldn't really sell out, so they might as well be great. They might as well be soulful and totally expressive. They could be successful, they could make a living, but they couldn't really be multimillionaires. So I think there's this inverse relationship in American culture between enormous success on a national level with the music industry in full force and greatness. I also think that black American music, which is the finest of the 20th century, I think, among pop music, fell apart, you know, after Michael Jackson sold 33 million copies. So this inverse relationship, I think, is kind of frustrating, because I think some of the biggest selling music nowadays is almost anti-music. It's like, well, we can't make great music, so we'll do this instead.
Daniel, it's a great point, and we'll pick it straight up as we do. Let's listen to one more of Tim Riley's nominees here for American Soundtrack. Here's Beck and Chemtrails. There's Beck with Chemtrails. He just posted it, new song, last month on his website and MySpace space to preview his upcoming album Modern Guilt, which, and here's the jumble of connections, is produced by Danger Mouse of Gnarls Barkley. Tim Riley, you've put it up here. Tell us why. And what about Daniel's observation that the quality of music these days is almost in inverse proportion to its sales, and that has a kind of a corrosive impact on the whole enterprise?
Well, I got to say, I hear things differently. I hear another pendulum swinging alongside the diversity unification pendulum, and that pendulum is when aesthetic greatness meets popular taste, and then when it swings away and we have popular taste that the critics do not agree upon as being great. And so we have a period in the 60s, everyone agrees, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, creating great art that's very popular. And that is really the exception in pop music. We don't see that happen very often. When it happens, it's tremendously exciting because there was a consciousness alive at the time that this stuff is really great. We're going to be listening to it for the next 40, 50 years. And there was that, those ideas were quite alive in the culture at the time. Now, we're in a very different space. We're so diverse. The music business is so messy. All these business models are collapsing. The floor is collapsing beneath the music business, and nobody knows where it's going to land. Well, this makes for tremendously exciting music making, and I have great faith in the artists who come along and are going to make sense of it all, or make sense of how little sense it makes, right? and those great unifiers have always come along in music history and taught us a great deal about the connections to be made between these things. Right now, the great unifiers that are coming along are fewer, and they're not. But one of the unifiers, I would argue, would be Danger Mouse. And that's one reason I chose both this Gnarls Barkley and the Beck thing, because he is really like the hot producer on the scene right now. Mm. And he has a way of creating records that look backwards as well as forwards.
Roxanne Orgill, if you could take William Count Basie and plop him down in the middle of the music of Danger Mouse and Gnarls Barkley, of Erykah Badu and Beck, do you think he would know where he was? Would it be a disorientation chamber for him? Or think he might? I mean, he was a pretty wild cat. He improvised on the hoof all the time. Would he figure it out? Would he recognize it as, I don't know, American airs to maybe himself?
Well, going out on a limb, I think that he might find a way to fit into it. One way or another, because he just had to play. So if that was the given music, he just might figure it out. He would feel pretty strange, though.
no doubt. What a long strange trip it's been, and yet standing on shoulders of giants here. Roxanne Orgill, your book is wonderful, Dream Lucky. It's really great history, great insight on a great musician, Count Basie, and we're so grateful to you for sharing it with us today. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Tim Riley, you're a great sport to come on and give us a few modern contemporary soundtrack nominees. Thank you so much for being here, Tim.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll go out with one more. Off Tim's list, here's Erykah Badu again with My People from the album New America. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.